From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. They call me Ben. We're joined with our long-suffering super producer, Paul Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. But Ben, you may be asking, where are your trusty co-hosts, Matt Frederick and Noel Brown? Without divulging too much information, I can reveal that they are both on separate secret missions for the time being, but they will return very soon. And I wonder now whether they are traveling by plane, train, or automobile, specifically a Volkswagen. You see, today's episode is about not a conspiracy theory, but an ongoing conspiracy, a cover-up of a global nature. Right? Not just one single incident, not one single year, but a cover-up spanning multiple industries, multiple countries, and multiple years. And what better way to investigate this conspiracy than to call on some help from our longtime friend and recurring guest on the show, ladies and gentlemen, How Stuff Works expert for all things automotive, Scott Benjamin.
How do you do, Ben?
How do you do?
It's good to be back in front of the mic.
Yeah. For some background here, everyone, Scott, you and I, for around a decade, a little bit short of a decade, hosted a very different show together called Car Stuff.
Yeah, that's right. We had a long, long run, and so we've got an incredible archive. And one of those topics that we talked about, of course, during that, you know, it was 9+ years, a little bit over 9 years. One of those topics was Volkswagen. Somewhere along the way, I don't think we ever covered a full history of Volkswagen, but we did cover the Volkswagen Beetle. We covered the Volkswagen 1 liter car, you know, some of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I know Volkswagen came up many times in the podcast. In fact, I own a Volkswagen.
That's true.
Yeah, oh. I currently own a Volkswagen, not an affected Volkswagen, which is lucky, right?
Yes, very fortunate. Yeah. And you know what? I owe you another thanks for coming on the show, because I completely forgot when we said, you know, Scott should be our guest for today's episode.
Yeah.
We completely forgot that you do, in fact, drive a Volkswagen.
Yeah, well, again, thankfully not one of the ones that had to be recalled. But this is an incredible story, one that unfolded in front of the media, in front of the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, there was a cover-up. We'll talk about that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it did span many, many years. And there was inside knowledge of this early on. You know, it was known to the company before it was released to the public. I mean, they were definitely trying to hide something.
Absolutely. And so for anyone listening to the show who is not specifically a gearhead or doesn't consider themselves a car person, we can guarantee that you are going to find some very strange and fascinating things nonetheless. And the story begins, I would say the story really begins in the late 1930s. Is that correct?
You're talking about the beginning of Volkswagen.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, sure.
We could talk about the beginning of Volkswagen. We'll just kind of quickly go over this. But one of the most fascinating things, if you look up Volkswagen, and I bet a lot of people don't quite understand this. They might know the tie-in between Adolf Hitler and wanting to build what they call the people's car. Right?
Sure.
That would be the Volkswagen Beetle.
The bug, yeah.
Yeah. He's actually credited as being one of the founders of Volkswagen, if you can believe that. I mean, the German labor front, who was under the control of Adolf Hitler at the time. So you'll find that Adolf Hitler is listed as one of the founders of Volkswagen.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting fact, I thought. But I mean, this starts in, 1937, I believe, is when Volkswagen became an official mark.
Right, yeah, headquartered in Wolfsburg, Germany. Mm-hmm. And that's the name Volkswagen Werk was just meant the people's car company, right?
Sure, yeah. And you know, the idea was to create something that the people could afford, the people could drive, the people could easily get their hands on. But it was also strictly controlled by the government, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that the direction was coming down from people that really didn't have how do I want to put this, Ben? It wasn't necessarily designed in a purely creative environment. It was somebody who was dictating what had to happen in that car. Like, this is the way we want it. This is the way it has to be.
Right. They were building to a list of constraints.
Exactly right. Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, with the Volkswagen and even the start of the company, I mean, if you notice the timing, we're talking about 1937. This is the onset of World War II. Mm-hmm. And so there was going to be a delay in production until after that. So very few Volkswagen Beetles, even though they were designed ahead of time, ahead of World War II, they were not really widely delivered until after World War II, because there's that gap in production because they shifted over to become a war machine.
Which happened with multiple manufacturers, not just on the Axis side, but on the Allied side as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Both sides of the ocean. Yeah, that was happening everywhere, is that, you know, car production pretty much halted during World War II.
And shameless plug, we have a pretty interesting series of episodes about that on carstuffshow.com, available for free.
Huge archive.
It's actually, we have a lot of stuff on that.
Yeah.
So let's move a little bit further ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, you look around at Volkswagens today and you see how popular they are, right?
Sure.
Drive in any major metropolitan area and you're bound to see several of differing years, different models, et cetera.
Sure.
But you have to ask yourself, all right, this is a Nazi car, right? How did this – not no offense, Scott. How did this Nazi car become so popular here in the United States? Because initially, sales were lower for two reasons. One was the association with Germany.
Yeah.
And the second was that the car was seen, I don't want to say seen like a twerp, but it was smaller and it had a differing form, you know, it was more rounded
sure.
than people were used to.
Yeah, rear engine. You know, it had a couple of different things going against it, I guess, as far as, you know, its sale in America. Because, you know, we at the time, we were in love with, you know, the giant vehicles. You know,
the
great big, the lead sleds, you know, the time, you know, the huge steel vehicles that were enormous. They were, 20 feet long, had giant V8 engines. It was just a different thing altogether, really. And it was tough to convince people until about – well, you know what? Actually, we have another podcast about this, but, you know, the officers that came back from World War II had kind of fallen in love with the British sports cars. And, you know, the small vehicle, you know, maybe that only sat two people, sometimes four, but, you know, it's a very small convertible vehicle, sporty. And that trend started to take off and really become popular in the 60s, I guess, is when, you know, they were doing a little bit of both. They were making some big cars. They were making some small cars, kind of and experimenting with, you know, where we're going to import cars from because these are popular. And, you know, the Volkswagen Beetle kind of fits snugly in there, but it wasn't until probably, late 1960s, early 1970s, that the Beetle really, really took off here in the United States.
And shot off like a rocket.
Yeah, and the reason was because of the oil embargo.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that in the geopolitical and the domestic circumstance, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is at a time wherein gas prices are skyrocketing for the average person, right?
Sure.
And a big land yacht, or what you would call a lead sled engine, is, you know, it's going to be a notoriously thirsty beast, right? It's not quite like an Abrams tank. We're not talking gallons per mile, but you're gonna be paying a lot in fuel even when prices are normal.
It was pretty close to gallons per mile.
Yeah, yeah, they were not eco-friendly.
No.
That wasn't even a term people would apply at the time.
Yeah.
But a smaller car with a smaller engine like the Bug is going to be suddenly much more attractive. And we've seen a similar thing happen when gas prices spiked several years back and a bunch of people realized they didn't like their H2s that much. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Those Hummers?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. So this is all happening in the early 1970s. I'll say – I think it was 1973 was really the first crunch for us here.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in 1979, the same thing happened again. So throughout the 70s really, there was a push to create smaller, more efficient vehicles, and Volkswagen had a vehicle that was ready-made for this. You know, they imported the vehicle, and it was wildly popular.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it had a long, long run, didn't it? I mean, it was it second after I can't remember, was it first or second? I think it was after the Model T.
I think it might be second. Let's see, because in 1972, they had already surpassed 15 million vehicles. Wait, so that would make them first.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
That would make them first.
Yeah, because they were produced well into the 1990s even in Mexico, I think.
And the Model T was what, 1908 to 1927?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this is an enormously popular vehicle. It recovers from a stigma associated with one of its original founders, Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
That's still the most baffling thing.
Well,
to me,
you know,
Scott.
Let's move on past that though, because this isn't just we're talking about a group of manufacturers of marks really now at this point. It's not just Volkswagen. So we're talking about Audi, Porsche, Lamborghini, Bentley, Bugatti. These are all owned under the parent company of Volkswagen. So in addition to that, there are other automobiles that we don't necessarily see here in the United States. There's in Spain, there's the Seat brand, which makes automobiles and auto parts. There's Scania, which is in Sweden. That makes commercial trucks. There's the MAN company, M-A-N, which is in Germany, and they also make commercial trucks and engines. And then there's Skoda, which is from the Czech Republic, and they make automobiles as well. So Volkswagen is this enormous worldwide company that produces millions of cars a year. We might not see as many here in the United States as they do elsewhere in the world. You know, there's still big numbers. They're a popular company here in the United States. I want to say they're like the number nine seller of vehicles right now, I think. I looked up the number yesterday, and I believe they're number nine in the United States. And that's a leap ahead of where they were, let's say, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, they were selling, you know, just it's probably tens of thousands still, but now they're selling hundreds of thousands of vehicles in the United States, if not, you know, over a million at this point. So, and again, that encompasses all their brands. Now, I know some of the smaller, you know, I shouldn't say smaller, but some of the more boutique type cars, I guess, you know, the Lamborghinis, the Bentleys, the Bugattis, they sell less, of course. Their primary, if you want to call it bread and butter, I guess, would be the Volkswagen brand, Audi brand, and even, I'll say even Porsche, because they sell a lot of cars here.
That's true.
Yeah.
I would say that.
Yeah. And strictly speaking in the U.S.
And we're establishing here that this is not a I don't know what we call it. This is not a cottage industry. This is not like a the rarefied air of high performance exotic cars. Like this is not McLaren doing something of this nature. So we have this massive car manufacturer, right?
Yeah.
We're talking millions of cars. We're talking billions of dollars. And then, of course, we're talking about the law, right? Because just the same way that the original VW Beetle was built according to a set of constraints, all vehicles in developed countries must conform to certain sets of standards. And this includes everything from, you know, the presence of airbags to brake standards, like when you apply a brake, to things like collapsible joints, you know, used in place of an accident. One of the big complaints you hear from a lot of high-performance car enthusiast is that these safety regulations primarily add weight, in their opinion. Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's to a lot of people, it's a lot of nonsense.
Sure.
But to other people, it's a necessity. You know, you have to have these things in order to produce and sell a vehicle in the United States or in the European Union or in the China market or, you know, wherever you're talking about. You have a certain market that you have to target for certain things, you know, and emissions is one of those things. They have cars that are U.S. emissions compliant, and they have cars that are European emissions compliant, rather. And those are two separate things. It's different systems. And I'll tell you, I found this out. I was kind of fascinated by this when I read this, and I didn't quite understand this, but someone had described it in this way, is that I guess what we're talking about is different types of exhaust gases that come out of the tailpipe, really, and what comes out of there. It's mandated by the government agencies that are in charge here. So in the United States, it's the EPA that's in charge of making sure that, you know, the vehicles are compliant to whether it's, you know, the country, the state, or even the county or the city that we're in, because it does vary state by state in that way. Sometimes it's just the county that you're in. Because here in Georgia, just because we're in the county that Atlanta is in, you know, the main city, the capital city, we are required to get admissions tested every single year. Every, once a year around your birthday, you have the admissions tested. Then it's when you get your tag renewal and all that. Mm-hmm. But if you're outside of that area, they don't care. There's no emissions testing. It's different from, by state by state. Some states, the entire state it's necessary. Other states, it's just certain areas like what we have here in Georgia. And then some of them have, year exclusions. Like, if your car is older than a certain age, it doesn't have to be tested. And some of them, the first 4 years, you don't have to have your car tested because it's a brand new car, which all this seems very arbitrary, I understand. But these are rules that are refined state by state. Mm-hmm. There's one overlaying rule from the government that says, in order to buy or to import and sell cars here in the United States, you have to meet these mandates. And the same thing with the European Union, except it's a set of directives that come down from, from their leadership.
It's a little more centralized.
Exactly right. Yeah. So they have a more standardized system for all of the European Union, really.
And of course, like any large manufacturer, Volkswagen has hundreds and hundreds of people whose sole job in the organization is to make sure that these cars meet these standards.
Yeah, and just so I'm clear on this, I mean, the U.S. and the European Union have different air pollution standards. So just take, for example, the U.S. standards are kind of strict on nitrogen oxides, which is – you'll see it abbreviated as NOx, and then particulate matter. Well, the European standards are more strict on carbon dioxide, which is CO2, and carbon monoxide. So – in other words, European regulators are focused on like fuel efficiency, and they try to limit the dependency on crude oil from Russia and the Middle East. Well, and on greenhouse gas emissions, of course, and of course climate change plays into all this. But on the other hand, American regulators are more focused on smog and the health impacts of the air pollution. So they have different standards based on what they're trying to achieve. For their air quality, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's not a crazy story. That all seems on the up and up. So what happens when things start to go wrong? We'll answer this after a word from our sponsor. Welcome back. Before the break, Scott, you and I explained some of the history of Volkswagen, the size of the organization, a couple numbers, and we also looked at their interaction with various governments. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lean too hard on the Nazi history. It's just a real thing, and you can fall down that rabbit hole if you wish, folks.
Sure.
But we've painted the scene. We've provided the backdrop. I'd like to ask you about the timeline that applies here. When do things start going wrong with Volkswagen?
Okay, so we didn't hear about this until right around 2015, right?
Yeah, September 2015.
Yeah, this is a couple of years ago, maybe almost 3 years ago at this point. And, people would probably be surprised to learn that this actually began. If you really want to get down to the root cause of this whole thing, mm-hmm. It started around 1999.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
So what happens?
All right. So in 1999, they're brand new U.S. rules. Now, they call them Tier 2 rules, which I think they have updated to Tier 3 at this point. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about the limits decreasing on what's allowed, for exhaust gas emissions. So we're talking about nitrogen oxides, things like nitric oxide and nitrogen dioxide, and mm-hmm. they're usually produced by the combustion of fuel, right? So the limits were decreasing from, I believe it's 1 gram per million to something like 0.07 gram per million.
Okay, so
yeah.
So it's a significant reduction.
It is. Yeah, it's reducing. And because of that, there has to be kind of a phase-in period when they allow, manufacturers to adjust to this, to, try to make their cars run a little bit more efficient, run a little bit more lean, I suppose, right? The problem with that is, and as we'll find out, is that you want to kind of have a balance between performance, of course, because people want performance in their car. They don't want to be just an absolute dog on the road, of course. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to have a vehicle that is just spewing emissions, because it takes more fuel probably in most cases to go faster, right? You're trying to get the most efficiency out of that fuel. And sometimes that requires burning more fuel. In fact, all the time that requires burning more fuel, right?
Right.
But you're trying to do that in a way that, you can filter, you can, run it as lean as possible while still maintaining this balance between performance and fuel economy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the idea.
Oh, we should also point out those nitrogen oxides that we're mentioning. Think of those as some of the key ingredients in air pollution. So these are the gases that are instrumental in the formation of stuff like acid rain or smog.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that this is difficult to do because they give the manufacturers 10 years. In order to conform to this. So they've got 10 years from 1999. So let's say 2009 is when these new standards are supposed to take place, right? They're going to phase them in. So throughout the 2000s, let's say 2004 through about 2009, there's this diesel emissions change as well. It's not just gasoline, it's diesel as well. So in 2007, Volkswagen officially suspended the sales of the current diesel lines, and they were waiting for new technology standards to come through.
Right.
They're developing new product is what they're doing, really.
They also this is also around the time that the European Union banned something that was pretty common in this diesel testing thing. Mm-hmm. And that was something called a defeat device.
Ah, yes. Okay. Now, the defeat device will come up later, I'm sure. But the defeat device is nothing that is exclusive to Volkswagen.
I think not
we should
at
just
all.
State
yeah.
that up front. That might also be kind of a shocker to people is that these defeat devices are known to exist for other companies. In fact, I've seen I think it's Renault, Suzuki. There were other companies that were mentioned that I'll be able to find it here in just a second in my notes. But the defeat devices really are there to save the car, save the engine really.
Right.
That's the primary purpose of them. It's so that if, you know, the car itself kind of figures out that something's not going right, that it's not operating in the right temperature range. It's not, mm-hmm. There's something, a load on the vehicle that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
It's not going to destroy itself. It's going to, in some way, save itself. It's going to try to self-preserve, I guess.
Or try to at least mitigate the damage.
And what we're talking about is a software situation. It's not a mechanical thing. It's an electronic thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to either increase, decrease fuel as necessary. It's going to, it's going to create a condition, I guess, that's more favorable to the engine.
And in 2007, the European Union finally introduced a rule for car makers that said you gotta stop using this defeat device loophole, because what they were doing with the software, which as you said, Scott, was designed to preserve an engine, what they were doing instead was using it to cheat on these tests. It would manipulate emissions and therefore performance, right? Or
yeah.
performance and therefore emissions, depending on whether the car was on the what they would call the test stand, mm-hmm. where you test the performance and see if it meets emission standards versus actually driving on the road.
Sure.
So the fancy insider automotive term for this, and I don't want to get too into jargon, is cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what was going on. I mean, and the other company that was listed, I mentioned, I think, Renault and Suzuki, but Hyundai also was known to have defeat devices that they've used in the past. And again, that's to prevent engine damage at certain temperatures. So it makes sense that, they would have something in place like that. But again, mm-hmm. when you use that, when you switch that on, that's the deceptive part here. So let's go back to 2007.
All right.
So again, defeat devices not exclusive to Volkswagen. A lot of places are using them. A lot of people are using them. Manufacturers, I mean by people, of course.
Right.
Not people. So it's nothing mechanical really, just all electronic. Mm-hmm. So back in 2007, I guess, there was talk of Volkswagen using this to skew the numbers a little bit, and Bosch, I guess, who is an engineering and electronics company in Stuttgart, Germany. A lot of people have heard of Bosch, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
They're a supplier of automotive components. They allegedly warned Volkswagen not to use their software, Bosch software, illegally. So, they knew they had control. They could manipulate the software how they wanted. But they said in 2007, please don't do that in order to conform to these new standards. There's a better way around this. Do it in a different manner.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2008, just a year later, Volkswagen announces that it has clean diesel cars. Now, I think we've probably all heard clean diesel. And this is right around when a lot of people really changed their mind about diesel in the United States. It wasn't something that was known as a dirty vehicle, a polluting vehicle.
Right.
Because prior to then, when you think of diesel cars, you think of cars that, trucks, cars that were terribly smoky and they just smelled bad all the time, mm-hmm. and they were just everything about them was different. I mean, they operate differently internally. They're tougher to start.
They're tougher to accelerate.
Yeah, it's just not – it wasn't something that was part of American culture, I guess, if you want to put it that way. There are certain uses for diesel vehicles, but it was primarily commercial, right? It was primarily people that – long-haul truckers and people that were using diesel equipment around, tree nurseries or something like that. They were using it in equipment, not necessarily in their on the road cars.
Sure.
Even though they were out there, they were kind of few and far between at that point. But now, in 2008, Volkswagen's got this clean diesel, and I remember that Mercedes came out with clean diesel, and a lot of places like to claim that they have clean diesel cars. And of course, you're not going to have any problem with emissions, right?
No,
none at all. And you're going to have all the performance that you want.
Things are going to be even better than you could imagine.
It's going to drive just like a gasoline-powered car.
Absolutely.
Yep. No problems at all.
So, what could go wrong?
All right. So the problem here is that around 2008, cars with what we'll call the test rigging software were starting to be sold in the United Kingdom. And they know that. They know that in 2008, they were still using this defeat device in order to kind of get around the emissions controls that were happening over in the European Union. And then in 2009, this is when the Volkswagen TDI cars officially went on sale in the United States. Now, in Europe, some of the models are also being described as Euro emissions class 5 vehicles. And, they have all these classes that they like to say that we're compliant to,
Sure.
And that will change throughout the years. I don't know if we want to keep up with that in this discussion, really, because I think it just kind of gets lost in the weeds somewhere. But around 2009 is when these TDI cars, the cars that all had a little badge, TDI, those are the ones that are considered to be clean diesel cars were sold here in the United States. And then I guess, from around what? I guess from 2009, right when they were introduced, until about 2015, and that's the key date, right? 2015, it seemed like there was really a big movement. A lot of people really like their diesel cars. They didn't have a problem finding the gas at gas stations because, more stations were carrying it now because there's this influx of cars that need or require diesel fuel. Mm. Now, you can't fill it up with gasoline, of course. So
Right. There's
that. It's just an easier vehicle to be able to fuel than it was, back when you had to go to a truck stop somewhere on the highway in order to get fuel. Now you could go to practically any gas station and fuel up, and you were getting the performance that you wanted out of it. It was just like your gasoline-powered car. Mm-hmm. They're brand new. It was something that at the time was, economical, I guess.
Sure.
They were fuel efficient. You had it all, really.
Until.
That's a long pause. Yeah. Until.
It was a little dramatic there. Until people started comparing notes.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. So, as we said at the beginning of the show, 2015 is sort of a harbinger of things to come, right?
Yeah.
So, here's what's happening. During this time and the years leading up to this moment, As we said earlier, different states, different countries, different counties within states all have differing standards, right?
Yeah, sure.
And largely a lot of the testing is going to be the same. It's just where they set the bar for passing or failing.
Yeah.
And what they're testing for, right?
Yeah.
So here in the United States, one of the states with more stringent standards would be California.
Sure.
In the automotive world, California is very well known for having emissions standards and pollution standards that are significantly higher
Sure.
than other states.
They have a group called CARB, which is the California Air Resource Board.
Mm-hmm.
And how many times in the past did you just remember back a couple decades, if you will.
Sure.
Think about like watching cars being given away on The Price is Right or, one of the game shows. How many times did you see them say when they're giving away a car, they would say that it's CARB certified or it has California emissions?
Right.
California emissions was a thing. And I don't know. I think it kind of still is, but that includes more states at this point. Now there are other states that have matched what California has done. So at the time, it was just them. But they had much stricter restrictions on – is that what stricter restrictions? restrictions, I guess.
Yeah,
that's fine. I guess they were very specific in saying that, you know, it's definitely got California emissions. It's California Air Resource Board authenticated, you know, that this is one that complies to that.
Absolutely. And at the time, that meant that you could drive this car anywhere.
Yeah, sure you could.
If you could drive it through California, you know what I mean? You're good to go anywhere.
You could take a car out of there, but if you were to move into California with another vehicle to have it tested, you would likely have to add a bunch of hardware in order to make your car, you know, as clean as the cars that were meant to be sold in California.
Yeah, you know, and at some points during that time, people moving to California would just sell their car.
Yeah. Yeah, it happened. And, you know, now there are many other states that have kind of followed suit with California in their same strict, strict restrictions on exhaust gases.
So in 2014, the year before the S hits the F, if we're going to keep it as a family show, right? The year before the Badgers pop out of the bag, CARB, the California Air Resource Board, is studying discrepancies that they've found between European and U.S. models of vehicles, right?
Sure.
And they take three different sources for 15 vehicles, and they find something not quite rotten in the state of Denmark yet, but, you know, they find something smelling a little ripe because several scientists, I believe, went in West Virginia – said, hey, there's something up with the diesel cars.
Yeah.
Because we had three that we tested, and what they're showing us on the road is vastly different. They're much, much dirtier than the test would indicate or than the auto manufacturers have promised.
So what's really unusual about this is that you could take those same three vehicles that you're talking about, you know, just random vehicles that they selected and put them into a test bay and measure the emissions and everything will turn out fine. They will certify as, you know, no problem at all. It's emissions compliant. You take that same vehicle and you attach mobile technology to it, I guess, you know, something that is that can test the vehicle while it's on the road, while it's driving. And they were finding that these cars were emitting sometimes 40 times the amount of permitted levels of nitrogen oxides.
40 times.
40 times the amount. So what is happening during these testing procedures?
Is it an accident? Is it somehow just these individual cars, right? Did something fail on these cars? That's the first question. Is there a defect?
Yeah, sure. And you might, you know, be scratching your head like, why would they go to West Virginia to check this out? They went to West Virginia University where they have something called the Center for Alternative Fuels, Engines, and Emissions. So they have something that's called, confusingly enough, CAFE, which is with an extra E, not CAFE standards, but with an extra E. CAFE.
And CAFE standards, just by way of reference, are a set of regulations that that cars have to obey in the United States.
Yeah, this goes back to what we were talking about in 1999 when they've got 10 years to comply to this, an overall fuel economy for your fleet of vehicles. More on that on car stuff if you want to go to it. Shameless plug. But so the idea was they were actually trying to do something nice here, I guess. They were trying to figure out, you know, some of the benefits, I guess, of U.S. diesel technology and hoping to have Europe kind of follow along with that and see if they could achieve the same low levels of nitrogen oxides for emissions. And instead, they found something different. They found these discrepancies, I guess, between, you know, the on-road emissions versus what was being published as, you know, the fuel standards or the emission standards, I guess, for diesel engines here in the United States. It just, the numbers weren't matching up for the West Virginia University researchers.
In any shape, fashion, or form.
No. Exactly right. So they did publish this. They published their findings. And the thing is, the publication, you know, they didn't want to say anything to Volkswagen directly, of course, because you don't talk about that kind of thing, I guess. You don't accuse them of what they thought was happening even this early on, you know, in 2014.
Right. It could still all be a mistake.
So they did publish these publicly. You know, they said that, you know, here's you know, what we found. Mm-hmm. And this got the attention of the EPA here in the United States.
And
unwanted attention.
Unwanted attention, yes. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, in September 2015, they issue a notice of violation of what's called the Clean Air Act to Volkswagen, to the Volkswagen Group. And they're the ones who levy the first accusation. They say, Volkswagen, you have intentionally programmed diesel engines to cheat on these tests, to activate emission controls during lab tests that which affects the output of the oxides that, Scott, you and I mentioned earlier, to meet these testing standards just while they're in the bay.
They're giving them a chance, though. They're saying, here's what we found. What's your explanation for why it's happening? You know, tell us what happened. Is it a mistake? Is this a genuine mistake? Because this is not the real world situation that we're finding with your vehicles. You know, in a test situation, it's one thing. In the real world, it's something completely different. Tell us what's happening here. You know, we want to talk to the engineers that helped work on this.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's someone you don't want to have knocking on your door is the EPA when you are in charge of the diesel engine program.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about some of the people that were involved in this later. I mean, there's a few people that wind up in the fallout of this whole thing. But so the timing of this is interesting because you would think that Volkswagen – now, they denied this right up to the very end. I mean, they really did put it off. And you would think they would just say, hey, you caught us. You know, like, I mean, but
I don't know, Scott. Is this a my bad situation?
I don't, you know what? I don't know. I mean, which one would have been better? Because here's what happened. The EPA gave them a chance. They said, we're telling you right now that these cars are not CARB, not EPA certified. They're not satisfying our standards. So why don't you tell us what you're going to do to change this?
So for a year. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
For a year, they say technical glitches, technical difficulties.
We're working on it.
Right. And the CEO at the time was a fellow named Martin Winterkorn. And they kept this line up. They doubled down. They committed to the bit, as you would say in comedy. And they did their best impression of a company that wasn't committing crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in September again, we're still in September of 2015. Mm-hmm. The EPA threatened to not certify any of the 2016 diesel engines that Volkswagen was going to sell. So they said, what are you going to do? I mean, we're not going to allow you to sell these cars in the United States. You're going to lose out on hundreds of thousands of sales.
Right.
Volkswagen finally responds to the EPA, not to the public, but to the EPA by admitting that the software was programmed to cheat testing. Now, this is September 3rd of 2015. Mm. By September 18th. Now, so that's 15 days later. So they had more than 2 weeks mm-hmm. for Volkswagen to come out with a statement, you know, whatever they wanted to say and to kind of, you know, gloss this thing over.
Right.
They didn't do it. The EPA actually comes out. There's a public service announcement from the EPA that orders the recall of all 2009 through 2015 cars that are equipped with this TDI engine here in the United States. And it wasn't until the 20th of September, so 2 days after the EPA announces this, that Volkswagen finally admits this deception and issues a public apology.
Mm-hmm.
So they were given practically a month. We're talking about practically a month where Volkswagen could have come out on the early side of this. I think they were kind of calling the EPA's bluff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like, are they going to say anything? Are they not going to do it? I'm sure that they were telling them that they were going to.
Right.
I don't know. It's just a confusing time right around September of 2015.
So Volkswagen CEO Martin Winterkorn says, I personally am deeply sorry that we have broken the trust of our customers and the public. And he was in charge from 2008 to 2015 when I believe he resigned.
So throughout the whole thing, really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was his ship.
Well, production, I guess, throughout the production of the whole thing.
He called it the terrible mistakes of a few people.
Hmm.
Right.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Yeah. But you know what? Okay, so this is another big question is who knew – you know, how far up the chain did they notify somebody that this was happening? Did he really know? Did he not know? That's another thing is that it was a secret that was kept from him. You're like, hey, Winterkorn, we've got some fantastic news. Our TDI diesels or our diesel engines, rather, are certified in the United States. And we got all the performance we wanted out of them, and we got the mileage that we wanted out of them.
Right. And did he just clap twice and say, great job, guys, that's lunch?
Yeah, exactly. You don't think he had any questions, any follow-up questions about, you know, how that was possible
mm-hmm.
and, some of the struggles that they had in the past? So I don't know. I feel like he did know something. I mean, I really – I genuinely do. But 3 days later, Okay, so we should say this. Stock went down immediately the next day.
By a third.
Yeah.
Easily.
Way down the very next business day. And Volkswagen was said that they were going to spend, I think it was like $7.5 billion, I think.
Yeah.
To cover the cost of the scandal, like, you know, for the recall, I guess. Because at this point, we're really just talking about a recall. It's nothing more. I shouldn't say nothing more, like I'm downplaying it, but it's huge. This is a great big recall. Winterkorn resigns. CEO resigns just 3 days after the announcement is made to the public. And so on September 23rd of 2015, he's out and someone brand new is in. And Volkswagen then just a week later announced that they were going to refit up to 11 million vehicles that were affected by these emissions, the defeat devices, I guess.
But they're still doing damage control. We have to interject because their new CEO is a guy named Matthias Mueller, and he says, okay, hold on, guys. The software was only activated in a part of those 11 million cars.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure it was.
So it smacks of damage control, but you can't blame people. Of course, that's what they would do. But now other countries are involved,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
So this has expanded beyond the United States, beyond, you know, Germany, and it's become known as Dieselgate.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the strangest things about this story, Scott, is that it continues to unfold. So mm-hmm. by the time our episode comes out, there will almost certainly be new developments in the mix.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's not just the vehicles that we've talked about. I mean, there were 2-liter vehicles. There were 3-liter vehicles. It encompassed Volkswagen. It encompassed Audi. Porsche was involved. They have a diesel engine as well in their Cayenne model. So it encompasses a lot of different parts of the company itself. You know, it's not just the one mark. It's not just Volkswagen. It's at least three other companies that are being forced, I guess. Actually forced because they're not going to do this voluntarily, really.
Right.
I mean, but they're being forced to make good on this. And there's a couple of programs that they set up in order to make things right. So Volkswagen set up what they call the Volkswagen TDI goodwill package. And, there were a lot of back and forth emails between dealerships and owners, I'm sure, and messages. But essentially, you can go online, you can check your balance. You know, you enter your VIN number, you see if your vehicle's affected, that type
right.
of thing. You know, you search to make sure yours is one of these. And then you can check like your – they give you a loyalty card, I think, mm-hmm. is one of the things that they do. It has cash on it. Another one is good only at the dealership. And then I mm-hmm. think another one was there's like a buyback program where you can, you know, trade in your vehicle, you can terminate your lease. And, you know, there's a lot of different variances between, you know, what happens based on what vehicle you have and mm-hmm. what they allow.
And
that's a terrible way to describe that. I'm sorry.
No.
If you go onto the site, I think it's called VWDieselInfo.com. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't have one of these, you can kind of find out what was made available to the owners there.
Right, right. And if you do happen to have a Volkswagen, it is well worth your time to check, if you haven't yet, to see whether your vehicle was affected mm-hmm. by this scandal, by this Dieselgate. And here on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, one of the things we often run into is corporate malfeasance, right? That's what this is.
Yeah.
And the questions that we always return to are sadly the same, and the primary question is always going to be, what happens to those responsible? Are there any consequences for these actions? And to the average consumer, regardless of which country they reside in, mm-hmm. it often seems that the so-called the fat cats or the titans of industry rarely have to face the music.
Yeah, they're not held accountable.
They're not held accountable yet. In this case, as legal proceedings continue, we can tell you that in several instances, people have been personally convicted or punished for this.
Yeah, very recently.
Very recently, yes, yeah. Scott. In December of 2017, mm-hmm. someone actually went to prison.
Sure. Not just someone, six people.
Yeah.
And in fact, one was here from the United States, Oliver Schmidt, He was arrested in Florida, and that was very recently. That was, again, in December. Did you say December of 2017, I think? Mm-hmm. And then there were five others, I believe. So we're talking about six top executives that have gone to jail or prison over this.
This is pretty unusual at this level in a corporation.
Well, you know, they've been charged. I'm not sure that they've actually been sentenced at this point, but they've been charged. So Volkswagen employees that were charged, there was Heinz Jacob Neusser, who oversaw the development of the company's brand. There was Jens Hadler, I believe that's Jens, J-E-N-S, mm-hmm. Jens Hadler, who oversaw the engine development program. And there's Richard Dorenkamp, who was another supervisor of the engine development. And then there was Bernard Gottwies, who helped oversee the quality management. And then there's Jürgen Peter, who was a liaison between regulatory agencies and the car maker themselves. So these are top executives. They're the top of the game here. Right. And they're being held accountable for what happened. And you know, this is – a lot of people say, well, finally, you know, we're getting some justice out of this. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, a lot of times something like this happens and you don't hear of anybody really taking responsibility for this.
Right.
They're not taking charge of the situation, saying, yeah, that was my decision.
Let me clarify the timeline here, because I said December of 2017. That is when Schmidt is sentenced. So these charges are probably a little bit earlier.
Oh, probably months earlier.
Yeah. He was originally looking at 169 years in prison, Scott.
Whoa.
On 11 felony counts.
So they don't take this lightly, do they? I mean, this is something very serious. And I don't know if we've even said this number yet, but, you know, we've thrown around a few numbers of what this is going to cost VW, right? In the end. And, you know, they were talking early on about per vehicle charges. And I think it was like 37, they could be fined something like, this is just here in the United States, $37,500 per vehicle that they sold in the United States. That's more than a lot of those vehicles cost to begin with, brand new.
Yeah.
So it's a healthy fine. I mean, it's a very big fine. And they were talking in the billions of dollars. And, you know, every day it seemed like there was more and more bad news coming out. In the end, this whole thing, you know, with the penalties and everything, they're finding out that this is going to end up costing the company something like $21 billion.
Billion.
With a B. That's right. And, you know, I think there's something like, you know, $4.3 billion of that is in just criminal and civil penalties.
Mm-hmm.
But then the rest of that is in what the company has to do, you know, either retrofitting the cars, either buying back the cars, giving out these courtesy cards. I forget what I call them, loyalty cards, I think. It's really, really expensive for them. But more than $20 billion is what this is going to cost the company. And more than that, this has cost this company their reputation.
Oh, yeah.
Volkswagen has been, if you paid attention to any of their public announcements recently, you know, gone to any of the websites, this is something that has just cut them to the core. They don't know what to do because they want to retain the people that they have already, that already believed in them.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those people won't buy another Volkswagen. They don't find that they can trust the company. And that's something that's really hard, is to earn that respect back again.
Which is a crying shame. So 2 points. First, on a personal note, I really like Volkswagens.
I do too.
And I, you know, I'm wondering if now would be the time for me to grab one, because I bet I could get a deal. But the second point is that this huge cost that occurs to Volkswagen, should mention, also hit the individuals who were tried or convicted. So Schmidt was facing 169 years in prison, 11 felony counts. For anyone who is confused about why you would hear an individual sentenced to almost 170 years in prison, we can offer some clarity. That's often, at least, to make sure the person actually does go to prison.
Sure.
And serves some sort of time.
Yeah, not 169 years, really.
We
know that.
They might not all stick, you know. It's just, it's upping the bar.
Yeah.
So he pled guilty, and he ended up getting a prison term of 7 years for his guilty plea.
That's still pretty stiff.
And $400,000 fine.
Oh, boy. Wow. Okay, well, 7 years in prison. I mean, that's not an easy sentence to take, you know. I mean,
right.
If you're going from your executive world to prison, it's you know, that's got to be tough.
Right. It's tough, and it's a consequence of this action. And
I wonder if the others are going to follow suit and have similar sentences.
Right, right. I know that some other people are getting convicted or have been convicted,
yeah,
right?
The other five, I believe, are over in Germany, somewhere in Europe. I'm not sure if it's in Germany. They might be in Spain or, you know, somewhere else. But, yeah, they are likely to see similar charges levied against them.
And there's more fallout in January of 2018. It was revealed that, get this, Scott, Volkswagen was also using monkeys in vehicle emissions experiments. With the stringent testing laws that a lot of countries have, this is, if not illegal, it's a very bad look. So,
this is not looking good on the face of it at all.
They did this in 2015. They had 4-hour-long experiments where they locked ten Java monkeys, in these tiny rooms, filled them with emissions to see, you know, like, what would happen.
Oh, that's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's awful.
I hate to hear about stuff like this, but it seems like the bad news just keeps piling on and piling on. Like, when is it all going to kind of settle? You know, when is it going to be over?
Right.
For Volkswagen.
What's the fallout?
Yeah.
As we're recording this today, that is an answer that we can only hope to find in the future.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But for now, we are going to conclude our examination of the real life automotive conspiracy, not a conspiracy theory, the great Volkswagen cover up. And Scott, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. Now, there are a couple of secret projects that you have in the works, which I don't believe we're – I'm looking at Paul here. I don't believe we're at liberty to divulge yet.
No, I don't think we are. Not yet. But I've got something that's keeping me busy for sure when I'm off mic. It's something that's going to be coming out hopefully, let's say midsummer, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your listeners will find it interesting.
We can only tell you that it would truly be a crime not to tune in.
Very clever.
Hey, I worked on that earlier.
Well, Ben, thanks for having me here today. I really appreciate it. I always love being on the show.
Oh,
and I hope that, you know, I did the topic justice. I know that, we probably skirted over some issues that people would like to hear a little bit more about, but that's one of the fascinating things about the story is that there are so many twists and turns and angles to look at this that, you know, you'd be doing yourself a disservice not to delve deeper into the story, because what we can cover in an hour is just scraping the surface, really. I mean, we're giving you the high points of it, but really dig into it and find out what's going on behind the scenes, and it's fascinating.
I would also call them the low points.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, thanks again for letting me be here.
Oh, likewise. Yeah, the pleasure is ours, sir. And of course, Matt and Noel send their regards on that. Wow, you've got a secret. Matt and Noel are on secret missions.
Mm-hmm.
God knows what Paul's up to. He's shaking his head and shrugging here. Am I the last one without secrets?
Maybe. I think you've got your own secrets.
I am a pretty sketchy individual. but yes, thank you, Scott. And just as importantly, friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Let us know. Do you drive a Volkswagen? Have you been affected by this? Do you think that the legal actions taken against this company are appropriate? Do you think instead their government's making an example of an auto manufacturer?
Yeah, is it too harsh or not harsh enough?
Right, exactly. Is there, for lack of a better phrase, is there a Goldilocks, you know, zone with this punishment? And also, what should this be applied to other companies? You know, what are other examples of companies that have committed massive fraud like this and have, you know, and what happened to their leaders at the time?
Yeah, can I add one thing too?
Please.
Just curiosity with the emissions thing in general. You know, why is it that only in Atlanta, in the state of Georgia, we have to have emissions when the rest of Georgia doesn't have to?
You're real sore about that one.
Well, I kind of am, because I've lived in places that you don't have to, and then across the street you do have to.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that type of situation. Mm. So, I'm just curious, like, what you feel about it on your, you know, personally? You know, what do you think about it? Like, do your neighbors have to do it, but you don't because you live across the county line?
Yeah, and it's not as if the air itself stays within a district.
No, exactly. So, you know, is it too arbitrary?
Mm-mm.
I mean, should it just be, you know, all-encompassing? Should everybody have to adhere to the same standards, or should we just have none? Mm-hmm. I mean, where would that put us? I don't know. I'm just fascinated by that whole thing, too.
Let us know. You can find the entire Stuff They Don't Want You to Know crew on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. You can also write to us directly via our email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.